just landed in jail. Look out, boys, they come down fast. Baby addiction of the wicked class. In your hearts or in your home, never have to be alone. Woman doors and wild attack, anything to catch a man.
Hello, this is Stark Raven on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
On Stark Raven, we take a closer look at what's happening inside Canadian prisons and prisons around the world.
I'm Tiffany Chong.
And I'm Emily Aspinwall.
We're your hosts for today's show.
Coming up on Stark Raven, we'll be talking about why Aboriginal women might be serving longer sentences than they should be.
We'll also hear from comedian and former prisoner Tommy Chong talk about his new book, The I Chong.
And we have news about some innovative programs happening at two Fraser Valley prisons, as well as more on Iraq, the Tory crime agenda, and drug testing on prisoners in the United States.
All that in the next hour on Stark Raven. An Aboriginal woman from Vancouver Island says that she was placed in a medium security prison last year when she should only have been in a minimum security prison. Tanya Lorraine Neal says that the Correctional Service of Canada discriminates against Aboriginal women when rating prisoners. She's now suing the CSC in a class action lawsuit. I spoke to Ms. Neal's lawyer, John Conroy, last week. He was on the line from his office in Abbotsford. Here's my interview with him now. Tanya Lorraine Neal end up in a medium security prison?
Well, when anybody is sentenced to a federal sentence, which is anything in excess of 2 years of imprisonment, their sentence is governed by something called the Corrections and Conditional Release Act and the regulations under it. And the Corrections and Conditional Release Act requires the Correctional Service of Canada to assign a security classification of either maximum, medium, or minimum to each inmate in accordance with the regulations. And then the regulations set out a number of factors that they're required to look at, such as the seriousness of the offense, any outstanding charges, behavior under sentence or history, and this sort of thing. And then to try and come up with a classification that essentially takes into account escape risk, risk to the public in the event of an escape, and something they call institutional adjustment. And depending on how you fit into those categories, you'll either do your time in a maximum security prison, which is obviously more restrictive than a medium one, or in a minimum one. And a medium one's obviously more restrictive than minimum. Minimum's obviously the place where most prisoners would like to be. It's less secure and has usually more access to the community, that sort of thing. And in the process of how they determine where or what the security classification is, the Correctional Service of Canada started some long time ago using a statistical type of tool to assist them in doing these classifications called the Custody Rating Scale. So prior to 1991, they used to make these decisions as individual judgments on the part of the correctional staff. And then the staff started using this tool that was that's the Correctional Service of Canada, CSC as we abbreviated, came up with. And they came up with this in an effort to standardize the decision-making process, essentially, and to try and predict institutional adjustment or risk to escape, risk to the public in the event of escape, and so on, and to try and eliminate disparity in their decisions. So it's a 12-item scale, and it's really got two sections or subscales. One is the institutional adjustment subscale, and there's five items on it. And the other is the security risk subscale, which has seven items. And each item is assigned a weight, and the subscale with the highest score determines security classification. And then the CSC itself did some research into it, and incidentally, this scale wasn't fully operational until about 95. But then some question arose with respect to the reliability and validity of it, especially in relation to women. The Auditor General of Canada in 2003 and the Canadian Human Rights Commission in 2003 and the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies in 2004 raised criticisms of the government in using it. And then academic researchers came into the debate, and they looked at it as well to see what was happening, particularly with Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal female offenders. And so the Commissioner of Corrections requested an independent review from the department on the validity of the scale as it applied to non-Aboriginal and Aboriginal women. And it was a fairly extensive review. And they basically found that when they developed this in the late 80s, there was a pilot study that they did, but there were some what they call conceptual and methodological weaknesses, because it rested on the ability to predict the best placement using this institutional adjustment index, but the variables that they used were multiple and diverse and not necessarily applicable. And on the security classification, most of the items that were selected from other security classifications that were being used at the time, there were problems with that as well. So they looked at this in detail, and they found that they weren't finding that it was that useful an instrument. There were some problems with it. And so they found, for example, that of a number of the items on one of the scales, when looked at current literature, they were actually poor predictors of what a person would do institutionally or afterwards. And some of the scoring rules were vague and poorly structured. For example, one of the items that they score people on is something called street stability. And so, you know, the caseworker looking at that can obviously bring quite a bit of subjective judgment to bear and on that sort of thing. And if you score higher, of course, you're going to end up in a higher security institution. So as a result of their research, they saw that there were problems with the research on male inmates and that they were compounded when they examined the results of the studies on female inmates. And so in their original studies, they focused on male offenders, and they had a small sample of female offenders. And it was difficult to interpret the findings for female offenders because of the very low frequency of many of the variables that they were looking at. They did another study in 2002, and with a six-month follow-up, and on the institutional adjustment, there were 291 women offenders, 61 Aboriginal and 230 non-Aboriginal, and they found that the scores on institutional adjustment predicted these institutional incidents by for Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal women, but the predictive ability of the security risk subscale was, the results were very discouraging. And the subscale predicted institutional incidents for non-Aboriginal women, but the scores didn't predict at all for Aboriginal women. So what they've said as a result of that study was that two items failed to predict institutional incidents. Escape history could not be scored due to insufficient data. And institutional adjustment on this subscale of the five items, two of the items that do not predict outcome were problematic. So the majority of the items in the security risk subscale did not predict institutional incidents for both Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal women. Now, this gets off obviously a bit technical because you're looking at all these scales and criteria and predictive scales, actuarial things, and so on. But basically, they found that these scales and the items that they were looking at are often based on criteria that were unrelated to the type of prison behavior. So their conclusion in the 2002 study was that the predictive validity of the security risk subscale for women in general was weak, and it was non-existent for Aboriginal women. So Aboriginal women, the decisions being made about them as to placement were not being made on a sound empirical basis. And they found that this was further exacerbated because Aboriginal women were rated as needing higher levels of security than non-Aboriginal women. In the 2002 study, 70% of the Aboriginal women were rated medium compared to 40% of the non-Aboriginal women. So they knew that Aboriginal women are less likely to incur institutional infractions than non-Aboriginal women. And so using this scale, they were over-predicting the security classification of Aboriginal women, and in the result, they were being classified in higher security than they should have been. So they were being, you know, the tool itself had a systemic bias into it that was affecting Aboriginal women particularly. And that's essentially what we're saying, is that they used this tool, and they knew from their own research that it was defective in relation to Aboriginal women in particular, and it's probably less than satisfactory for women generally. And so they were over-classifying them, and they simply continued to do that. And so when Ms. Neal heard about this issue, she came forward and was willing to be a class or a representative. So our approach is to seek to have a class of Aboriginal women offenders who were classified as medium certified as a class by the court, so we can then advertise to others who are members of that class to join in the class action to seek damages for these women who ended up doing harder time than they ought to have under the security classification scheme.
Have you heard of other Aboriginal women that have, you know, in this area or across the country that have come forward?
We haven't heard of any as yet because we aren't at the stage where we've got the class certified and then can do the advertising. But we're told that there may be anywhere from 300 to 500 other women who are in this category.
And has this classification system being challenged before in the courts?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Individual decisions by people in individual cases, you know, they may have challenged their security classification, but and they may have even gone to court saying, you know, I should have been minimum when I'm medium and that sort of thing. But it wouldn't have been on the basis of the tool that was being used having this built-in problem. You know, it would have been on individual factors.
I understand that Tanya says that she hasn't ever had a criminal record before, hasn't been to prison before, and that should have been a factor in terms of determining what class of security she was placed in. Is that the case?
Yeah, well, that's certainly one of the factors that they look at under the legislation itself, you know, leaving aside the custody rating scale. They're obviously going to take into account the person's a first-time offender as opposed to somebody who's got a record. And then, of course, it would depend upon what they have a record for.
Okay. May I ask what she did was convicted of in order to go to prison?
No, we haven't been disclosing that at this point.
Okay.
We don't see it as really being relevant to the issue.
Okay. Now, if you are able to move this case forward so that it does go to the court as a class action lawsuit, what would the potential impact be?
Well, hopefully the women would be compensated for the misclassification on the basis of this tool. Hopefully the Correctional Service of Canada will stop using the tool for people in relation to whom it's found to be invalid, such as Aboriginal women. And they'll, you know, come up with a better, proper system which fairly classifies people.
And so is it the Correctional Service of Canada that puts together this classification system?
They, through their research people and so on, came up with this tool in order to try and predict or, you know, more accurately try and classify people.
And have you had any reaction from them as to whether they think there are flaws in their system or whether they plan to make any changes?
Certainly not since filing of the action. What happens in the usual course is you sue, and this particular case, we've named Her Majesty the Queen and Right of Canada, so it gets filed in the federal court, and then the Department of Justice gets a copy of it on behalf of the Government of Canada, and they file an appearance to it, and then it's up to them to file a statement of defense. And so our communications will be with people at the Department of Justice, and they'll be there on behalf of the Government of Canada, and specifically, of course, any agents of the government, such as people from the Correctional Service of Canada.
And when do you expect to have this heard in court or have this...
It'll be some time, because it's not an application which you can get on quickly. It's going to take, some time first to be certified, then to have the time with the advertising, then to see how many we've got. And then, meanwhile, the other side, the defendants, through their counsel, may raise all kinds of issues about the claim. There may be a number of early skirmishes in terms of the issues and the procedure and so on. And then there'll be usually what we call examinations for discovery, where both sides examine under oath parties representing their respective positions in order to flesh out the entire situation. And, you know, there'll be exchanges of documents and all these sorts of things. And then eventually you set it down for trial. And if it isn't settled in some way before trial, well, then we'll have a full trial hearing here in Vancouver.
Do you have any statistics as to how much time Aboriginal women are doing more than they perhaps should be doing?
No, I don't have anything like that at this point.
Do you expect you might be able to get that information out within
the
course of this?
Well, we expect that once we have access to all of the government's own research data into this particular scale, that it will demonstrate that Aboriginal offenders in general, and women in particular, scored much higher on the scale, resulting in them being overclassified. And so, you know, we'll be looking at and trying through the discovery process to determine, you know, exactly how many this did happen to once they started using the scale completely.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was John Conroy. He's the lawyer of an Aboriginal woman who is launching a class action lawsuit against the Correctional Service of Canada. You're listening to Stark Raven on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
We're going to go now to a song by Eliza Gilkinson off her album Land of Milk and Honey, and this song's called The Ballad of Yvonne Johnson. And Yvonne Johnson is an Aboriginal prisoner who has been forced to face the discriminatory practice of the classification system in Canada's prison system. She's also the co-author of a book about her life called Stolen Life. And she co-authored that along with Rudy Weeb. And if you haven't had a chance to read that book, I would definitely recommend it. But this is called Ballad of Yvonne Johnson by Eliza Gilkinson.
My name is Yvonne Johnson. My native blood is Cree. I'm here to tell the story of a life stolen from me. My grandfather's grandfather was a great war chief, Big Bear. And Flora, my grandmother, worked with medicine and prayer. My mother is Saskatchewan, my daddy ex-marine, and I was just a half-breed falling somewhere in between, somewhere in between. Raised up in a reckless world of drugs and alcohol, the police killed my brother Earl, the only one who cared at all. Cleft palate split my face in two, no surgery could repair. I lived in shame and ridicule, foundations of despair, foundations of despair. First memory of my brother Leon, I was only three. He threw me on the table, forced himself inside of me. All the kids stood around as I descended into hell. When I told my daddy about it, and he had his way as well, boys, he took me down as well. I didn't have a language for the pain I suffered through, escaping into marriage, but your past just catches up with you. Until I had three children and a ragged family, a desperate urge to keep them from the wolves that got to me, boys, wolves that got to me. Stuck him with a dagger.
It is time for the news here on Stark Raven.
Healthcare workers in jails across British Columbia recently rejected a tentative contract. The contract affects more than 200 nurses, social workers, pharmaceutical technicians, and clerical workers. They were on a work-to-rule job action before the tentative agreement was reached. 10 provincial jails were affected by the job action. The prison staff are employed by Joy Morris Health Services. They are a private contractor hired by the Liberal government of Premier Gordon Campbell and are used to provide nursing and other healthcare services at provincial jails. There have been ongoing complaints from prisoners and community support organizations about the quality of healthcare at provincial prisons. They say the situation has worsened over the last 5 years with the privatization of the health services.
The federal government plans to unveil legislation that would make it more difficult, if not impossible, for those facing gun-related charges to be released on bail. Justice Minister Vic Taves plans to toughen the bail provisions in the criminal code by introducing a so-called reverse onus provision. Such a change would essentially put the onus on those facing charges to convince the courts that they do not pose a danger to the community. This is just one more addition to the Tories' ideological-driven tough-on-crime agenda. There are currently two active related bills before Parliament. One introduces mandatory minimum sentences for those convicted of gun crimes. Another ends house arrest for those convicted of various violent crimes. Mr. Taves also hopes to introduce legislation that would repeal the Faint Hope Clause. The Faint Hope Clause allows prisoners serving the maximum sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole for 25 years, allows them to apply for early parole after doing 15 years of their sentence. Vic Taves has also recently floated the idea of lowering the age of criminal responsibility for children from 12 to 10, and is also looking into reducing or eliminating preliminary hearings from the judicial system.
Prisoners at the Fraser Valley Institution have started helping some dogs get back into the community. The Langley Animal Protection Society is training minimum and medium security prisoners to operate a shelter for abused and rescued dogs. The new program started in mid-August and has 6 women taking part in the training. The women are learning dog grooming and training skills. Their first students are 12 dogs that the Langley Animal Protection Society has categorized as unadoptable because of their disobedient and antisocial behavior. The organizers of the program say that everyone will benefit from this program. The dogs will be trained and adoptable, and the women will have skills that can be used once they leave prison. The prisoners are also operating a doggy daycare for prison employees and members of the public. Those interested in adopting a dog from the program or placing their dogs in the daycare can contact the Langley Animal Protection Society.
The watchdog that oversees the RCMP says the force's expanding anti-terrorism surveillance activities are not being properly scrutinized. The Commission for Complaints Against the RCMP said that it is struggling to keep tabs on the ever-expanding role of the National Police Force. Since the Federal Anti-Terrorism Act was passed in late 2001, the Commission has not always been able to obtain the proper documents to investigate potential abuses of power. The Complaints Commission wants to become an auditor with full access to all information about RCMP activities, and they are asking the federal government to update the related legislation. Another issue is that the commission is complaint-driven, which means it often only learns of concerns from media reports. The RCMP employs 22,000 people and has a budget of $3 billion.
And we'll continue with the news here on Stark Raven. It's harvest time in the Fraser Valley, and that means that a group of prisoners at Ferndale Prison will be extra busy. 10 prisoners at the minimum security prison near Mission will harvest about 30 tons of organic vegetables, fruits, and flowers. The produce will all be donated to food banks and other aid organizations in the Lower Mainland through the Salvation Army. One group benefiting from the produce is the Miracle Valley Detox Center. They say the organic vegetables will provide nourishment for their patients who are severely underweight due to drug use. The farm is about 5 acres and is located behind the Ferndale Institution. Darren Getson is a prisoner who works the fields every day starting at 6:30 in the morning. He says the work is hard, but he enjoys it. Getson says he thinks about the homeless and needy in the downtown east side whom his vegetables will go to feeding. In fact, the farm will provide enough food to make 180,000 meals. Prisoners started plowing and fencing the land 2 years ago. This is the first year that crops will be harvested. Officials at the Ferndale Institution are making arrangements for prisoners from the medium security Matsqui prison to work on the farm as part of an early reintegration program.
A U.S. federal panel of medical advisors has recommended that the government loosen regulations that severely limit the testing of pharmaceutical drugs on prisoners. These new proposals are dredging up a painful history of medical mistreatment. They have also sparked debate among prisoner rights advocates and researchers about whether prisoners can truly make uncoerced decisions given the environment that they live in. Until the 1970s, about 90% of all pharmaceutical products were tested on prisoners. But such research diminished sharply in the mid-70s after revelations of abuse inside prisons. In one situation in Philadelphia, prisoners were paid hundreds of dollars a month to test items as varied as dandruff treatments and dioxin. They ended up being exposed to radioactive, hallucinogenic, and carcinogenic chemicals. In another case, a 40-year study on syphilis saw several hundred mostly illiterate black men with syphilis who were left untreated even after a cure was discovered. This was done so that researchers could study the disease. Critics of this plan also doubt the merits of pharmaceutical testing on prisoners who often don't even have access to basic health care. Human rights advocates also cite concerns over the financial motivations in such research. Under current U.S. regulations, prisoners can participate in federally financed biomedical research if the experiment poses no more than a minimal risk to the subject. The discussion about changing the testing regulations comes as the biomedical industry is facing a shortage of testing subjects. In the past 2 years, several pain medications, including Vioxx and Bextra, have been pulled off the market because early testing did not include large enough numbers of patients to catch dangerous problems.
A Canadian program that helps lifers prepare for parole is making its debut in the U.S. The Colorado Department of Corrections announced that 4 prisoners serving life sentences will take part in the Lifeline program. The program was started in Canada 15 years ago. Lifeline is led by lifers who have been released and are doing well on the outside. The outside lifers mentor prisoners through a 6-month to 1-year curriculum that's aimed at preparing them for community corrections and parole review. The program doesn't guarantee parole, and Lifeline participants must go through a review and interview process. The Colorado Department of Corrections had originally chosen 6 prisoners, but 2 were removed from the program because of opposition from victims groups and police. The 4 participants of Lifeline will start their program within the next month.
Iraqi authorities have formally taken over the Abu Ghraib prison. The prison became notorious after photos of U.S. forces torturing and sexually abusing prisoners hit the mainstream press. The Iraqi government has not yet decided what they are going to do with the now empty Abu Ghraib prison. The former detainees were transferred to a new $60 million prison that is part of Camp Cropper. It's located near the Baghdad International Airport. The U.S. occupying forces in Iraq still have about 13,000 detainees in their custody. And that's the end of the news here on Stark Raven. And we'll be back with a feature. And...
And some announcements.
All right, and we're going to hear a song in a moment from Mecha Normal off their new album, The Observer.
Tras de la tormenta, repite su acorde de guitarra. Esta revolucionaria apasionada, esta revolucionaria apasionada. ¡Aguanta! ¡Fúbaje! ¡Ahí va! ¡Otra vez! Ella conoce la pasión. Con el viento entona su canción. Y tras de la tormenta.
Like some woman, any woman that some guy is trying to pull one over on.
That is Gene Smith and David Lester of Mecha Normal off their new album, The Observer, and that's the track Arsenal. And the album features some of Gene's experiences internet dating. It's well worth a listen if you can get your hands on it.
You're listening to Stark Raven on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. Former Vancouverite and comedian Tommy Chong has released a new book about his experience inside a California prison. The book is called The I Chong, Meditations from the Joint. In 2003, Tommy Chong was targeted by two American investigations which sought out businesses selling drug paraphernalia. He was charged for his part in financing and promoting his son's handmade bong business. Tommy Chong agreed to plead guilty to one count of conspiracy to distribute drug paraphernalia in exchange for non-prosecution of his wife and his son. Tommy Chong was in prison from October 2003 to July 2004. He was recently interviewed by Chris Goldstein of the podcast Normal Daily Audio Stash. This is an excerpt of his conversation with Chris Goldstein about his new book and his experiences in prison.
I was amazed about this journey that you took. You know, you've had your run-ins with the law before, but never anything as serious as this. Did you ever think that anything like this would happen, that the authorities would have ever come down on you so hard?
Well, you know, I had premonitions, but I had no idea what they were trying to, you know, what was trying to be said to me or warned. I had warnings. You know, like I used to even talk to the bongs. I used to hold the bong and say, "What are you trying to tell me?" You know, of course the bong couldn't talk, so I can just see the bong going, "Ah, idiot, you're going to get busted. Put me down." But, you know, I had premonitions, but I had no idea that of that nature that would happen to me.
Tommy, later in the book, you talk about this older inmate standing in line with his colostomy bag. Really doesn't care about pissing people off anymore. You know, did he perhaps influence some of the straightforwardness in this book to say what you want to say?
Absolutely, absolutely. It was one of those things, you know, how low can you go? You know, what else is he going to do to me? And old Lester, he was a beautiful guy. I loved Lester, and yeah, a lot of guys influenced me. You know, I met a lot of people in there. I met a lot of good people. I met a lot of bad people, just like out on the street. But one thing, you know, I've earned my cred, my street cred. You know, I'm totally cool now.
And when you talk about the good people and the bad people you met in there, I was just astounded at this give and take that you really had with everybody. You're playing casino, you're playing bocce ball, but you also brought them a lot of philosophy. What happened when you brought the I Ching, the actual I Ching book, into the prison there?
It changed a lot of people's lives, like I Ching would, you know. Like I said in the book, you know, the one kid read it, and, you know, and then he sat on his bunk for the rest of the day because, you know, the I Ching said, you know, you had suffered a terrible loss, and he'd lost his wife and child in a car accident. And so a lot of people, you know, that every it affected everybody that read it, everybody that had their own reading, you know, and it helped so many people, you know. One guy did it, and he had a lot of time to do, and he asked if he was going to be with his wife at the end, you know, when he got out. And I Ching said that life is like a French movie. the ending is always a surprise, but it's always the right ending. So he had no idea. But when the I Ching said, the ending will be the right ending, that gave him peace of mind.
And you talk about this street credit, you know, Tom, you got major, massive street credit talking about the drug war now, and you don't hold back in this book either. How do you think that things are going to change? I mean, do you think that people talking about it will make this difference now?
Well, the change is, you know, the thing is you can't live a lie, you know, and this country's been living a lie for a lot of years now. And that eventually that lie will die of its own lack of nourishment, you know, it will wither. The Bible talks about, you know, that parts of, you know, the tree will die away, and the branches will wither and die. And this is what's going to happen to the DEA, and this is what's going to happen to the war on drugs. You know, people will realize the sham and the lies that support this. And the more they realize it, the less nourishment the lies will have, and eventually there will come a time when that law will be voted right out. It'll be like the end of Prohibition. You know, it will end probably with a little whimper, and then people will be able to relax and not worry about, you know, their house being broken into like what happened to mine. So it's just a matter of time. Everything is a matter of time, and that's one thing we have a lot of. In fact, we have an eternity of time, so no matter how long it takes, you know, it's still a lie. It doesn't matter if the lie persists for another year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, or for my lifetime. Eventually, it will die of its own accord.
In the book, you talk about fasting a bit, and I was so amazed at this epic struggle that you really undertook. It was like a lesson in nonviolent civil disobedience, really, and of self-control. You know, why did that, how did you come to fasting, and how did it affect you?
Well, the food was so bad, it was easy. You know, the food was so bad that, and bad for you. You know, the more you ate, the more hungry you felt. And so when I started fasting, I just got closer and closer to the source. You know, I got closer to God, and it was biblical. And I started getting lightheaded and revelations and beautiful thoughts, and it was incredible. And I did it once a week, every week. And the time just flew by, because all of a sudden it would be Monday again, and I was like, oh, I got to fast, and it became a control issue. The only thing you can control in prison is your appetite, you know. And I when I learned to control it, I also passed that on to other people. I heard from other people. They said, you know, I'm doing what you're doing, man, you know, and I lost 30 pounds and I feel much better inside and out. So it was such a positive thing, man. That's what prison became to me. Prison was like, you know, when you go to the gym and you push weights, it was like one big weight that I had to just work on for 9 months. And when I got out of there, I was stronger than ever before.
Now, let me ask you, do you still play bocce ball?
You know, I haven't played since I was in prison, but I'm thinking of putting a court in my house so I can play. I think I'm putting it down in my basement. You know, I'm doing the basement. I'm really considering a bocce court down there.
Now, let me also ask you, Tommy, you know, although you were the one that went to prison, it had a huge effect on your family as well. You know, what's the biggest change for you and your family since all this went down?
It was such a positive effect on my family, you know, in a lot of ways. And my son went back to school. He's second or first term law. He's studying to be a lawyer. My other son became a Bikram's yoga teacher. My daughter, you know, she gave birth to a beautiful little guy, and she's also pursuing her acting career. My wife went up to Canada and parlayed our investments up in Canada into a mini fortune. So everything was positive because I was on a positive trip. And you know, even though, you know, I was incarcerated, it was for the good. And so everything good happened to us. I can't tell you, man. Everything, my life has been such a blessing from the time I went in to till now that all I can do is really just be humble and thank the powers that did it for me.
And Tommy, as a native Canadian, and I know you travel back and forth, you're touring constantly, there's a big difference between Canada and the United States right now, especially when it comes to pot. I mean, what do you see as the big difference now, and sort of maybe a little bit over the years?
Well, you can see Canada is not as corrupt as America. That's the biggest difference. You know, it should be like two jurors, two people doing jury duty, you know, and you got one honest person, and then you got one guy on the take. You know, United States is the guy on the take, you know, totally corrupt from head to foot, totally corrupt, but governed by a constitution that is so iron tight that even these fools can't budge it. And this too shall pass. Canada, on the other hand, has that parliamentary system, and therefore, you know, these fools can be voted out with a vote of confidence. You don't have to wait for an election. You can just kick them out whenever, you know, things start going bad. You just have a vote of confidence, and away they go. And so Canada is honest, and the United States is dishonest. That's the difference.
There seems to be this overwhelming theme of honesty and liars out there, and you point that out a few times in the book. Has that experience of going to trial, or was it prison itself that made you really cherish honesty?
It started with the arrest. It started when they raided my house. You know, it was all a charade, and it was sham. It was a bogus attempt at cheap publicity. And and my as my spiritual being got stronger, you know, my bullshit meter, you know, just kept ticking and ticking and ticking. It got stronger. And now I can listen to people and I can look them and I can tell liars, you know, just by the way they talk and by the way they hold themselves. And so I really evolved in that. Before, I was too involved in with myself, you know. And now I look at people and I see them for what they are. And in most cases, it's a pretty nice sight. In some cases, it's pretty sad. But no, it changed me all for the good.
And, you know, one final question for you here today, Tommy. You dedicate the book for the millions of victims incarcerated as a result of the U.S. government's drug laws. Having been there now, what's your best recommendation to get through that time? So many Americans are fit with the same bill. What's your recommendation for how to get through that?
I tell everybody, you know, take advantage of the time that you have totally to yourself, where you don't have to worry about what you're going to eat, what you're going to dress, you know, what you're going to wear, where you're going to live. That's very rare in a person's life. And so that means that you can read, you can learn, you can study, you can think, you can meditate, you can become, just get so within yourself that you become such a powerful force as a person that you can affect change everywhere you go. And it's very rare for people to get that chance. And everybody goes to jail for a reason, you know. And I would tell people, you know, don't go on the injustice of it all. Just enjoy, like I did, enjoy the fate that you created. I created my fate, and people that go to jail, they create their own fate. But profit from it, you know. Don't sit in misery and don't worry and don't fear, you know, just profit from it, learn from it and enjoy it. It's life. That's what we only learn from our mistakes, and the bigger the mistakes, the bigger the lesson. And you know, life goes on, and just you know, be a part of it and just be happy.
That was comedian Tommy Chong talking about his new book, The I Chong, Meditations from the Joint. It was an interview that was first broadcast on Normal's Daily Audio Stash, and that's a podcast about ending the prohibition of marijuana in the U.S. Time is almost up here on Stark Raven, so we just have a couple announcements.
Right. I was getting excited about the announcements there. And here is one. Art Against Brutality is on Saturday, September 16th. That's next Saturday. And it's a community celebration of the resilience of the spirit and the healing power of art. So there's going to be music, dance, spoken word, testimonials, painting, all kinds of stuff. So they're encouraging people to get involved. It's going to be at Oppenheimer Park on the Saturday from noon till dusk. And if you want more information, go to artagainstbrutality.blogspot.com. Or you can call 682-3269, extension 7400. And we hope to have some folks from the Art Against Brutality event on Stark Raven next week. So tune in next week to find out more about Art Against Brutality.
Indigenous youth from Kaya, Redwire, and Justice for Girls are encouraging all communities, organizations, and nations to join in a march, feast, and hip-hop show called Take Back Our Streets, Take Back Our Voice. That's happening September 7th at 4 p.m. The march will start at the Blends Coffee Shop at Broadway and Commercial Drive at 4 p.m. If you want more information, you can email firstladyproductions@gmail.com. Now, that's the end of this week's Stark Raven. You can catch us next Monday here on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
We can also be heard live on the internet at coopradio.org, or you can hear many of our interviews by going to prisonjustice.ca.
If you'd like to sign up for Stark Raven's email newsletter on prison news and topics for upcoming shows, just email us at stark-raven@coopradio.org.
And if you have any questions about the show, you can reach us here at the station for the next few minutes. Give us a call at 604-684-7561.
And if you like what you heard today, consider supporting Stark Raven by becoming a member of Vancouver Co-op Radio. Your donations are tax deductible, and Co-op Radio is the only listener-supported radio station in Vancouver, so we rely on your support to create these programs.
And keep your dial tuned to Co-op Radio 102.7, because Think Indian is coming up next at 8 p.m.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Louise Croft for teching tonight's show.
And we're going to go now and hear The Clash, The Guns of Brixton. And this goes out to our old host, Suzanne, who was with us for many years and liked to play this song.
Trigger.